Chapter 56. There was one client who would not have been invited to the debtor's cocktail party. He was Mr. Horace Dumbleby, the butcher of Aldgrove. As an inveterate non-payer, he fulfilled the main qualification for the function, but he was singularly lacking in charm. His butcher shop in the main street of picturesque Aldgrove village was busy and prosperous, but most of his trade was done in the neighbouring smaller villages and among the scattered farmhouses of the district. Usually the butcher's wife and married daughter looked after the shop while Mr. Dumbleby himself did the rounds. I often saw his blue van standing with the back doors open and a farmer's wife waiting while he cut the meat, his big, shapeless body hunched over the slab. Sometimes he would look up, and I would catch a momentary glimpse of a huge bloodhound face and melancholy eyes. Mr. Dumbleby was a farmer himself in a small way. He sold milk from 6 cows which he kept in a tidy little byre behind his shop, and he fattened a few bullocks and pork pigs which later appeared as sausages, pies, roasting cuts and chops in his front window. In fact, Mr. Dumbleby seemed to be very nicely fixed, and it was said he owned property all over the place. But Siegfried had only infrequent glimpses of his money. All the slow payers had one thing in common. They would not tolerate slowness from the vets. When they were in trouble, they demanded immediate action.
"Will you come at once? How long will you be? You won't keep me waiting, will you? I want you to come out here straight away."
It used to alarm me to see the veins swelling on Siegfried's forehead, the knuckles whitening as he gripped the phone. After one such session with Mr. Dumbleby at 10 o'clock on a Sunday night, he had flown into a rage and unleashed the full fury of the PNS system on him. It had no loosening effect on the butcher's purse strings, but it did wound his feelings deeply. He obviously considered himself a wronged man. From that time on, whenever I saw him with his van out in the country, he would turn slowly and direct a blank stare at me till I was out of sight. And strangely, I seemed to see him more and more often. The thing became unnerving. And there was something worse. Tristan and I used to frequent the little Aldgrove pub, where the bar was cosy and the beer measured up to Tristan's stringent standards. I had never taken much notice of Mr. Dumbleby before, although he always occupied the same corner, but now, every time I looked up, the great sad eyes were trained on me in disapproval. I tried to forget about him and listen to Tristan relating his stories from the backs of envelopes, but all the time I could feel that gaze upon me. My laughter would trail away and I would have to look round. Then the excellent bitter would be as vinegar in my mouth. In an attempt to escape, I took to visiting the snug instead of the bar, and Tristan, showing true nobility of soul, came with me into an environment which was alien to him, where there was a carpet on the floor, people sitting around at little shiny tables drinking gin and hardly a pint in sight. But even this sacrifice was in vain, because Mr. Dumbleby changed his position in the bar so that he could look into the snug through the communicating hatch. The odd hours I was able to spend there took on a macabre quality. I was like a man trying desperately to forget. But quaff the beer as I might, laugh, talk, even sing, half of me was waiting in a state of acute apprehension for the moment when I knew I would have to look round. And when I did, the great somber face looked even more forbidding, framed by the wooden surround of the hatch. The hanging jowls, the terraced chins, the huge brooding eyes, all were dreadfully magnified by their isolation in that little hole in the wall. It was no good. I had to stop going to the place. This was very sad, because Tristan used to wax lyrical about a certain unique, delicate nuttiness, which he could discern in the draught bitter. But it had lost all its joy for me. I just couldn't take any more of Mr. Dumbleby. In fact, I did my best to forget all about the gentleman, but he was brought back forcibly into my mind when I heard his voice on the phone at 3 a.m. one morning. It was nearly always the same thing when the bedside phone exploded in your ear in the small hours. A carving. Mr. Dumbleby's call was no exception, but he was more peremptory than might have been expected. There was no question about apologizing about ringing at such an hour as most farmers would do. I said I would come immediately, but that wasn't good enough. He wanted to know exactly in minutes how long I would be. In a sleepy attempt at sarcasm, I started to recite a programme of so many minutes to get up and dressed, so many to go downstairs and get the car out, etc. But I fear it was lost on him. When I drove into the sleeping village, a light was showing in the window of the butcher's shop. Mr. Dumbleby almost trotted out into the street and paced up and down, muttering, as I fished out my ropes and instruments from the boot. Very impatient, I thought, for a man who hadn't paid his vet bill for over a year. We had to go through the shop to get to the bar in the rear. My patient was a big, fat, white cow, which didn't seem particularly perturbed by her situation. Now and then she strained, pushing a pair of feet a few inches from her vulva. I took a keen look at those feet. It is the vet's first indication of how tough the job's going to be. Two huge hooves sticking out of a tiny heifer have always been able to wipe the smile off my face. These feet were big enough, but not out of the way, and in truth, the mother looked sufficiently roomy. I wondered what was stopping the natural sequence.
"I've had me hand in," said Mr. Dumbleby. "There's a head there, but I can't shift out. I've been pulling them legs for half an hour."
As I stripped to the waist, it was still considered vaguely sissy to wear a carving overall. I reflected that things could be a lot worse. So many of the buildings where I'd had to take my shirt off were primitive and drafty, but this was a modern cowhouse, and the six cows provided a very adequate central heating. And there was electricity in place of the usual smoke-blackened oil lamp.